I crashed down to the ceiling of the car, embedding broken glass in my cheek and aggravating a dozen sore spots on my body. I groaned and slowly tried to raise myself, looking to the front seat to check on Earl. Earl? He wasn't there.
Mister, I better get you out of there. I smell gas. I think the tank ruptured.
I turned back to my would-be rescuer.
Where's Earl?
He shook his head.
Is Earl your chauffeur?
Yeah. Where is he? I reached up to pull a piece of glass out of my cheek. I could feel the blood on my fingers.
He got thrown out, the rescuer said. He's lying over there. He looks bad. I don't think...
Well, the paramedics will be able to tell. I called them. I called 911 and they're coming. He looked at me and nodded.
Thank you, I said. Here, let me help you out. This thing could catch on fire.
It wasn't until I crawled out and struggled to my feet, hand on my rescuer's shoulder, that I saw Earl lying face down on the embankment above the Lincoln. Blood was running down the concrete in a thick stream from his neck and face area.
You got lucky, the man said.
Yeah, I'm Mr. Lucky, I said. I took my hand off his shoulder and leaned forward until my hands reached the concrete. I crawled up the embankment to Earl. I knew right away that he was dead. He must have been thrown clear, and then the car rolled over him. His skull was crushed, and his face was misshapen and ghastly to look at. I sat down on the concrete next to him and looked away. I saw the rescuer looking up at me, an expression of horror on his face. I knew my nose was broken and blood was dripping down both sides of my mouth. I guess I was ghastly to look at as well.
Did you see what happened? I asked.
Yeah, I saw it. It was a red tow truck. The thing hit you like you weren't even there, and then it kept going.
I nodded and looked down. I saw Earl's outstretched hand, palm down on the bloody concrete. I put my hand on top of it.
I'm sorry, Earl, I said.
Part 3. The Man in the Hat. Monday, June 17th. Chapter 29. The prosecution took 8 days to present its case against André Lacasse, strategically finishing on a Friday, so the jurors would have the whole weekend to consider its case in full, before hearing a single word from the defense. Bill Forsyth, the deputy DA, had been workmanlike in his presentation. Nothing fancy, nothing over the top. He methodically built his case around the videotaped interview of the defendant and attempted to solidly wed it to the physical evidence from the crime scene. On the tape, Lacasse said he grabbed Gloria Dayton by the throat during their argument. Forsyth coupled this with testimony from the medical examiner, who said that the hyoid bone in the victim's neck had been fractured. This coupling was the center of the case, and all other aspects, testimony, and evidence emanated from it like the concentric circles of waves from a stone thrown into a lake. Yes, Judge Lego had allowed the admittance of the damning video, dismissing my motion to suppress the day before the start of jury selection, with the single comment that the defense had failed to show that the police had used coercive tactics or had operated in bad faith in any way during the interview. The ruling was not unexpected, and I immediately chose to see the silver lining in it. I now believed I had the first solid grounds for appeal should the verdict ultimately go against my client. Through the video, Forsyth gave the jury motive and opportunity, using the defendant's own words to establish them. In my many trials over nearly 25 years as a practicing attorney, I had found nothing more difficult than undoing the damage inflicted upon defendants by their own words. So was the case here. Jurors always want to hear from the defendants, whether in direct testimony, videotape, or audiotape. It's in the instinctual interpretation of voice and personality that we form our judgments of others. Nothing beats that. Not fingerprints, not DNA, not the pointed finger of an eyewitness. Forsythe threw only one curveball at me, but it was a good one. His final witness was another escort for whom Lacoste had formerly provided digital services and management. The prosecutor claimed that he had come forward only the day before, after learning of the trial for the first time while reading the newspaper. I argued against his being allowed to testify, accusing the state of sandbagging, but to no avail. Lego said testimony of prior bad acts of a similar nature was admissible and allowed Forsythe to put him on the stand. Brian Brandy Goodrich was a small man, no more than 5'3". He wore tight stonewashed jeans and a lavender polo shirt on the witness stand. He testified that he was a transvestite who worked as an escort managed by André Lacoste. He testified that André had once choked him into unconsciousness when he thought Goodrich was withholding money from him. When Goodrich came to, he was handcuffed to a floor-to-ceiling pole in his living room, and he watched helplessly while Lacoste ransacked his home looking for the missing cash. Brandy brought all the usual histrionics to the stand with him. He tearfully recounted that he had feared for his life and felt lucky he hadn't been killed. At the defense table, I leaned to André and smiled and shook my head as though this witness was just a nuisance and not worth taking seriously. But what I whispered to him wasn't so lighthearted. "I need to know right now, did this happen? And don't hang me out there with a lie, André." He hesitated, then leaned in close to whisper back, "He's exaggerating. I handcuffed him first to this stripper pole he had in the living room so I could search the place. I didn't choke him out. I grabbed him by the neck one time so he would look at me and answer my questions. He was never unconscious, and it didn't even leave a mark. He went to work that night." "He didn't quit or go with someone else?" "He didn't quit for 6 months, not until he found a sugar daddy." I leaned back away from André and waited for Forsythe to finish his direct. When it was my turn, I countered initially with a few questions I hoped would remind the jurors that Brandy was a prostitute and that he had never made any report of this near-death experience to the police. "Which hospital did you go to have your neck treated?" I asked.
"I didn't go to the hospital," he answered.
"I see. So the hyoid bone in your neck was not crushed as it was with the victim of this case."
"I don't know about the specific injuries in this case."
"Of course not. But you say you were choked into unconsciousness by the defendant, and you never went to the police or to seek medical attention."
"I was just happy to be alive."
"And to work, too, correct?"
"I don't understand the question."
"You went to work as an escort the same night after this supposed life-and-death struggle took place, didn't you?"
"I don't remember that."
"If I produced Mr. Lacoste's business records regarding his bookings for you as a prostitute, would that help you remember?"
"If I worked that night, it was only because he made me and threatened me if I didn't."
"Okay, let's go back to the alleged incident. Did the defendant use one hand or two?"
"Both hands."
"You're a grown man. Did you defend yourself?"
"I tried, but he's a lot bigger than me."
"You said you then woke up handcuffed to a pole. Where were you when he allegedly choked you into unconsciousness?"
"He grabbed me from behind as soon as I let him in the apartment."
"So, he choked you from behind then?"
"Yes, sort of."
"What do you mean, sort of? Did he choke you or not?"
"He put his arm around my neck from behind and tightened it, and I tried to fight because I thought he was going to kill me, but I blacked out."
"So why did you just testify that he used two hands to choke you?"
"Well, 'cause he did. Hands and arms."
I let that hang out there for a few moments for the jury to consider. I thought I had successfully dented Goodrich's credibility in a few places. I decided I should get out while I was ahead and took one last shot in the dark. It was a calculated risk, but I operate under the belief that voluntary witnesses usually want something in return. In this case, Goodrich obviously wanted revenge, but I had a hunch there was something more. "Mr. Goodrich,
Are you currently facing any criminal charges, misdemeanor or felony, anything at all? Goodrich's eyes flicked toward the prosecution table for a split second.
In Los Angeles County? No.
In any county anywhere, Mr. Goodrich. Goodrich reluctantly revealed that he had a solicitation case pending in Orange County, but denied he was testifying in exchange for help with that. No further questions, I said, my voice dripping with disdain. Forsythe tried to clean things up on redirect, hammering home that he had made no overture or promise to do anything to help Goodrich in Orange County. Goodrich was allowed to step down after that. I felt I had gotten a few good swings in, but still, the damage was done. Through the witness, the prosecution had added a history of similar actions to the solid pillars of motive and opportunity already established. Forsythe's case was complete then, and he rested it at 4 p.m. Friday, guaranteeing me a weekend of fitful sleep and panicked preparation. Now it was Monday, and it would soon be my turn in front of the jury. My task would be clear: to undo what Forsythe had done, to change the minds of the 12 jurors. In past trials, my goal had been to change just one mind. In most cases, hanging a jury is as good as a not guilty verdict. The DA often chooses not to retry and to soften its stance on a disposition. The case is a sick dog, and it needs to be put down as quickly and as smoothly as possible. In the defense trenches, that is a victory, but not this time, not with André Lacasse. I was convinced that my client was many things, but not a killer. I felt certain that he was innocent of the charges, and so I needed all 12 of the gods of guilt to smile upon me on the day of the verdict. I sat at the defense table, waiting for the deputies to bring Lacasse in from lockup. Those of us in the courtroom had already been alerted that the bus carrying him from Men's Central was delayed in traffic. Once the defendant arrived, the judge would come out from chambers and the defense's case would begin. I passed the time by studying a page of notes I had jotted down for my opening statement. I had reserved the opener at the start of the trial, exercising my option to address the jury before the presentation of the defense. This is often a risky move, because it means the jurors may go several days before hearing any sort of counterargument to the prosecution's theory of the case and presentation of evidence. Forsythe gave his opening statement to the jury 12 days earlier. So much time had passed, it would seem that the state's side was deeply and unalterably entrenched in the minds of the 12. But I also felt that the jurors had to be dying to finally hear something from the defense, to hear the response to Forsythe, the video, and the scientific and physical evidence. They would start to get all of that today. At last, at 9:40, Lacasse was brought through the lockup door and into the courtroom. I turned and watched as the deputies led him to the defense table, removed the hip shackles, and sat him down next to me. He was wearing the second suit I had bought for him. I wanted him to have a different look than he'd had last week as we started the defense. Both suits had come off the rack in a 2-for-1 deal at Men's Warehouse. Lorna chose them after we'd checked out Lacasse's own clothing and found nothing that presented the conservative, business-like appearance I wanted him to have in court. But the new suits did little to disguise his ongoing physical decline. He looked like someone suffering in the latter stages of terminal cancer. His weight loss had gone unchecked during his 6+ months of incarceration. He was gaunt, had developed rashes on his arms and neck in reaction to the industrial detergent used in the jail laundry, and his posture at the defense table made him look like an old man. I constantly had to tell him to sit up straight because the jury was watching. "André, you doing okay?" I asked as soon as he was seated. "Yeah," he whispered. "The weekends in there are long." "I know. They still giving you medicine for your stomach?" "They give it, and I drink it. But I don't know if it's doing anything. I still feel like I'm on fire inside." "Well, hopefully you won't be in there too much longer, and we'll get you into a first-rate hospital as soon as you get out." Lacasse nodded in a way that indicated he couldn't quite believe
he would ever leave the shackles in the jail behind. Long-term incarceration does that to an individual, eats away at hope, even in an innocent man.
"How are you doing, Mickey?"
he asked.
"How is your arm?"
Despite his own circumstances, Andre never failed to inquire about me. In many ways, I was still recovering from the crash of the Lincoln. Earl had died, and I was battered and broken, but mostly on the inside. Physically, I'd suffered a concussion and needed surgery to reset my nose. It took 29 stitches to close various lacerations, and twice a week physical therapy sessions since then to help restore full motion to my left arm, where ligaments were torn in the elbow. To put it bluntly, I got off easy. People might even say I walked away. But the physical injuries didn't even approach the intensity of the internal damage that still lingered. I grieved every day for Earl Briggs, and the sorrow was only equaled by the burden of guilt I carried with it. A day didn't go by that I didn't recheck the moves and decisions I'd made in April. Most damning was the decision to keep the tracker on my car and to taunt those monitoring my movements by boldly driving to Victorville to see Hector Moya. The consequences of that decision would be with me forever. The image of a smiling Earl Briggs attached to them in my mind's eye. By the time the wreckage of the Lincoln was examined, the GPS tracker was gone. But it had been there the afternoon before when Cisco had checked out the car. There was no doubt in my mind that I was followed to Victorville. And there was no doubt in my mind about who made the decision to send the Lincoln into the guardrail. If not, did the deed himself. I had only one true purpose with this trial. That was to free Andre Lacoste and clear his name. But I considered destroying James Marco in the process to be an integral part of the trial strategy. When I looked back on what happened up on the 15 freeway, only one thing came out of it that could even remotely be considered good. A rescue helicopter transported both me and Earl to Desert Valley Hospital back in Victorville. Earl was dead on arrival, and I was admitted to the ER. When I came out of surgery, my daughter was there at my bedside, holding my hand. It went a long way toward healing things inside me. The trial was pushed back almost a month while I recovered, and that cost had been borne most heavily by Andre. Another month of incarceration, another month of withering hope. He never once complained about it. He only wanted me to get better. "I'm good," I said to him now. "Thank you for asking. I can't wait to get started because now it's finally your turn, Andre. Today, we start telling a different story."
"Good."
He said it without much conviction. "You just gotta concentrate on one thing for me, Andre."
"Yeah, I know, I know. Don't look guilty."
"You got it." I gave him a playful punch on the shoulder with my good arm. It had been the mantra I had given him from day one. Don't look guilty. A man who looks guilty is found guilty. In Andre's case, it was easier said than done. He looked destroyed, and that wasn't too far off from looking guilty. Of course, I knew something about looking guilty and feeling guilty. But like Andre, I was trying to play my part. I hadn't had a drink since the night before jury selection began. Not even on the weekends. I was sharp, and I was ready. For Andre, today was the first day of the rest of his life. Mine too.
"I just wish David was here," Andre said in a whisper so low I almost didn't hear him.
Reflexively prompted by what he'd said, I turned slightly and my eyes swept across the rear of the courtroom. As had been the case since the start of the trial, the gallery was almost empty. There was an accused serial killer on trial in Department 111. And that was drawing most of the media. The Lacoste case had gotten scant attention in the news, and the cynic in me decided this was because the victim here had been a prostitute. But I did have a cheering section. Kendall Roberts and Lorna Taylor sat in the first row, directly behind the defense table. Lorna had been making periodic visits throughout the trial. This was Kendall's first day watching. Wary of coming to the courthouse and possibly seeing someone from her past, she had stayed away until I had pointedly asked her to come for at least my opening statement. We had grown close since April, and I wanted her there for emotional support. And in the back row were two men who had been in attendance every day since the start of jury selection. I did not know their names, but I knew who they were. They wore expensive suits but looked out of place in them. They were muscular and had deeply tanned skin from lives seemingly spent outdoors and not in courtrooms. They had the same build as Hector Aronde Moya, with wide, sharp shoulders, and I had come to think of them simply as Moya's men. They were part of the contingent of protectors Moya had dispatched to watch over me after the car crash in the mountains. I had turned down his offer of protection that day in the visiting room. It was too late for Earl Briggs now, but I didn't turn down the offer a second time. But that was it. No one else was watching the trial. Lacoste's life partner, David, was missing from the benches. He had split, having staged a full withdrawal of Lacoste's remaining gold and leaving town on the eve of the trial. More than anything else, that loss contributed to Andre's demeanor and downward spiral. In a way, I understood it. Having Kendall in the courtroom was a special thing for me. I felt supported and less alone, like I had a partner in the fight. But my daughter had so far not set foot in the courtroom, and that hurt. The hospital room reunion had only gone so far in rekindling the relationship, and school was no longer an excuse, as it had let out for the year halfway through the prosecution's case. I think my reflexive act to check the gallery was actually one more hopeful search for her. "You can't worry about that now," I whispered to Andre and myself. "You have to look strong. Be strong." Andre nodded and tried to smile. When David had taken the gold and run, Lacoste wasn't the only one he had left high and dry. By then, I had already taken receipt of a second bar of gold as continuing payment. A third bar was due at the start of trial, but the gold was gone by then. So a case that I had earlier viewed as a potential financial bonanza had turned pro bono as the trial began. Team Holler was no longer getting paid. At exactly 10 o'clock, the judge emerged from chambers and took the bench. As was her custom, Judge Lego eyed Forsythe and me and asked if there was any business to consider before she brought in the jury. This time there was. I stood, holding a set of documents, and said I had an amended witness list for the court to consider and approve. She waved me up to the bench and I handed her a copy of the new list, and then dropped another one off with Forsythe on my way back. I was barely seated again when Forsythe stood to object. "Your Honor, counsel is engaged in an age-old practice of deception by trying to hide his real witnesses in a sea of names. His pretrial list was enormous, and now he's added what I estimate to be 20 to 25 more names, and it is evident most of these will not be actually called." He gestured with the pages behind him to where Lee Lankford sat in a row of chairs against the rail. "I see he has my own DA investigator on here now," Forsythe continued. "And let's see, he's got not one, but now two federal prisoners on here. He's got one, two, three prison guards. He's got what looks like every resident in the victim's building." He abruptly cut off the litany and dropped the pages on his table, as though depositing them in the trash. "The people object, Your Honor. It would be impossible to respond beyond that without being allowed the time to look at these names and determine their relationship, if there is any at all, to the existing case." Forsythe's objection wasn't a surprise. We had counted on it in the defense plan and strategy we had dubbed Marco Polo at the top of the whiteboard Lorna had gotten installed on the brick wall of the boardroom back at the loft. The witness list was the opening move in that gambit, and so far, Forsythe was playing his part, though he had not yet, at least vocally, paid attention to the one name on the list that was most important. The name we called our depth charge, sitting there, beneath the surface and waiting to be detonated by the first false move by the prosecution. I stood to respond to the objection, taking another quick glance behind me as I rose. Still no daughter, but a small smile from Kendall. As my eyes swept forward, they caught and locked for a moment on Langford. He looked at me with an expression that was 60% "what the fuck is this?" and 40% the usual "fuck you." That 60% was what I was hoping for. "Your Honor," I said, looking finally at the judge, "it seems obvious from his objection that Mr. Forsythe already does in fact have knowledge of who these people are and how they would relate to the case. Nevertheless, the defense is happy to allow him time to review the new names and respond. There is no need to interrupt the trial, however. I am planning to regale the jury with my long-delayed opening statement and then begin with witnesses who were on the original witness list and already approved by the court." Lego seemed pleased to have been handed an easy solution. "Very well," she said. "We will take this up first thing tomorrow morning. Mr. Forsythe, you have until then to study the list and have your response ready." "Thank you, Your Honor." Lego called for the jury. I stayed standing and read over my notes while the jurors were seated, and the judge explained that I had reserved my opening statement at the start of the trial and would deliver it now. She reminded them that the words I would speak were not to be construed as evidence, and then turned the floor over to me. I stepped away from the defense table, leaving my notes behind. I never used notes when I was directly addressing a jury. I maintained maximum eye contact the whole time. The judge had earlier ruled that during openers, each attorney would be allowed to stand in the space directly in front of the jury box. This is known by lawyers as the well of the courtroom, but to me, it has always been the proving ground. I don't mean proving in a legal way. I'm talking about proving yourself to the jury, showing them who you are and what you stand for. You have to first gain their respect if you want any hope of proving your case to them. You have to be fervent and unapologetic about standing for the accused. The first juror I locked eyes with was number 4. She was Mallory Gladwell, age 28, and a script reader for a movie studio. Her job was to analyze scripts submitted to the studio for purchase and development. As soon as she was seated and questioned during voir dire, I knew I wanted her on the jury. I wanted her analytical skills when it came to storytelling and logic. I wanted the jury to ultimately choose my story over Forsythe's, and my gut feeling was that Mallory Gladwell could be the one who led them there. Throughout Forsythe's presentation of the state's case, I kept my eyes on Mallory. It was true that I watched all of the jurors, trying to read faces and pick up tells and cues as to what testimony or evidence had the strongest impact on them, what they were skeptical about, what got them angry, and so on. But I had Mallory down as the alpha. My guess was that her skills at breaking down a story would lead her to be a voice, if not the voice, during deliberations. She could be my Pied Piper, and therefore, she was the one I made the first eye contact with, and she would be the last. I wanted her invested in the defense's case. The fact that she returned the eye contact and did not look away was a strong signal to me that my instincts were on target. "Ladies and gentlemen," I began, "I don't think any introduction is needed here. We are well into this trial, and I'm pretty sure we know who everybody is. So I'm going to be pretty brief here, because I just want to get to the case. To the truth about what happened to Gloria Dayton." As I spoke, I unconsciously moved 2 steps forward, spread my hands, and put them down on the front rail of the jury box. I leaned forward, trying to make the communication between one man and 12 strangers as intimate as a one-on-one with a priest or a rabbi. I wanted each one of them to think I was talking only to them. "You know, lawyers have all sorts of nicknames for things, including juries. We call you people the gods of guilt. Not in any sort of disrespect for religion or faith, but because that's who you are, gods of guilt. You sit here and you decide who is guilty and who is not, who goes free and who does not. It is a lofty and yet weighty burden. To make such a difficult decision, you must have all the facts. You must have the whole and true story. You must have the proper interpretation of the story. I glanced again directly at Mallory Gladwell. I lifted my hands off the rail and moved back into the well so I could cover the entire 12 and the two alternates in a tight back-and-forth sweep. As I spoke, I casually moved to my right so that most of the jurors were looking at me on their left. I ask that over the next few days or week, you pay close attention to the defense's case. You've heard only one side of the story so far, the prosecution's side. But now, you are going to hear and see another side. You are going to see that there are two victims in this case. Gloria Dayton, of course, is a victim. But so, too, is André Lacasse. Like Gloria, he was manipulated and used. She was murdered, and André has been set up to take the fall for it. Realistically, my job here is to sow the seeds of doubt in your mind. If you have reasonable doubt when it comes to André's guilt or innocence, then it is your job to find the defendant not guilty. But over the next few days, I will go beyond that, and you will come with me. You will come to know that André is completely innocent, and you will come to know who really committed this terrible crime. I paused here, but kept my eyes moving across the faces of the jurors. I had them. I could tell. Now, before closing, let me just address something that I'm sure has bothered you throughout the presentation of the prosecution's case. That is Mr. Lacasse's means of making a living. To tell you the truth, it bothers me too. Essentially, he's a digital pimp. And like many of you, I am a parent, and it disturbs me to think about someone profiting from the sexual exploitation of young women and men. But the verdict you will deliver in this case is not to be influenced by what André Lacasse does for a living. You cannot judge him guilty of murder simply because of what he is. I ask you to think of the victim in this case, Gloria Dayton, and ask yourself, did she deserve to be murdered because she was a prostitute? The answer, of course, is no. And so, too, is the answer to the question, should André Lacasse be convicted of murder simply because he is a pimp? I paused, put my hands in my pocket, and looked down at the floor. It was time for the big finish. When I looked up, my eyes came directly to Mallory's. In closing, I make you a promise that you can hold me to. If I do not make good on what I say here, then go ahead and find my client guilty. It's a gamble I am willing to take, and that André is willing to take, because we know where the truth is. We have the righteousness of the innocent. I paused again, hoping Forsythe would throw out an objection. I wanted the jury to see him challenging me, trying to stop me from speaking the truth. But the prosecutor wasn't off the first bus from law school. He knew what he was doing, and he held back, not giving me what I wanted. I moved on. The defense will put forth evidence and testimony that proves Mr. Lacasse is nothing more than a patsy, an innocent patsy in the worst kind of scheme. A scheme in which those we trust the most have conspired to frame an innocent man. This is a story about how a conspiracy to protect a hidden truth ultimately led to murder and cover-up. It is my hope, I turned and used a hand gesture to indicate André Lacasse, as it is Mr. Lacasse's hope, that you will find the truth with us and return the appropriate verdict of not guilty. Thank you very much. I returned to my seat and immediately checked my notes to see if I'd forgotten anything. It looked like I had hit all the highlights, and that pleased me. André leaned over and whispered his thanks. I told him he hadn't seen anything yet. I think we will now take the morning break, the judge said. When we come back in 15 minutes, we will begin the defense's presentation. I stood as the jury got up and watched them move single file through the door to the assembly room. I watched Mallory Gladwell move with her head down. Then, at the last moment, just as she was about to slip through the doorway and out of sight, she turned to look back into the courtroom. Her eyes landed on mine and held for the split second before she was gone. As soon as the judge adjourned, I headed out to the courthouse hallway to check the status of my first witness. Chapter 30. The real reason I had fled the courtroom the moment the judge adjourned and the jury left was to get to the restroom. I had been up since 4, thinking about the trial and readying myself for my opener. I had kept the fire stoked with copious amounts of coffee, and now it was time to purge. I saw Cisco sitting on a bench in the hallway next to Fernando Valenzuela. "How we doing?" I asked as I walked by.
"We're great," Cisco replied.
"Yeah, sure," Valenzuela said. "I'll be right back," I said. A few minutes later, relief was flooding through me as I stood at the urinal. I even had my eyes closed as I replayed some of the opening statement in my mind. I didn't hear the restroom door open and didn't realize someone had come up behind me. Just as I was zipping up, I was pushed face first into the tiled wall over the urinal. My arms were pinned and I couldn't move.
"Where's your cartel protection now?"
I recognized the voice as well as the breath of coffee and cigarettes.
"Langford, get the fuck off me!" "You want to fuck with me, Holler? You want to do the dance?"
"I don't know what you're talking about, but if you ruin this suit, I'm going to see the judge about it. My investigator's sitting out there. He saw you come in." He yanked me off the wall and twirled me into the swinging door on a toilet stall. I recovered quickly and looked down at my suit to check for damage and buckle my belt. I did it nonchalantly, like I wasn't concerned in the least about Langford's menacing me.
"Go back to court, Langford." "Why am I on the list? Why do you want me on the stand?"
I walked over to the row of sinks and calmly washed my hands. "Why do you think?" I asked.
"That day in the office," he said, "you said you saw me wearing a hat. Why the fuck would you say that?"
I looked up from my hands to the mirror and looked at him. "I mentioned a hat?" I reached over and pulled down a handful of paper towels to dry my hands.
"Yeah, you mentioned a hat. Why?"
I threw the wet towels in the trash can, turned, and then hesitated as though I was recalling something from the distant past. Then I looked at him and shook my head as though confused.
"I don't know about the hat. But I know if you touch me again like that, you're going to have more trouble than you can handle."
I opened the door and stepped out into the hallway, leaving Langford behind. I could barely contain a smile as I approached Cisco, who was still on the bench with Valenzuela. The first rule of Marco Polo was to keep them guessing. Langford would soon have more than his hat to worry about.
"Everything okay?" Cisco asked.
"Langford, try to grab your dick in there?" Valenzuela added.
"Yeah, something like that," I said. "Let's go in." I opened the door to the courtroom and held it for them. As they passed by me, I checked the hallway for Langford and didn't see him. But I did see my half-brother walking down the hall, a thick blue binder under his arm.
"Harry!"
He turned without breaking stride and saw me. He smiled when he recognized me and stopped.
"Mick, how are you, man? How's the arm?"
"It's good. You in a trial?"
"Yeah, in 111.
"Hey, that's the one stealing all the media from my trial." I said it mock protest and smiled.
"It's a cold case from 94. A guy named Patrick Sewell, one sick puppy. They brought him down from San Quentin, where he was already doing life for another murder. They're going for the death penalty this time."
I nodded, but couldn't bring myself to say good luck. He was, after all, working for the other side.
"So, anything new on your driver?" he asked. "They hook anybody up yet?"
I looked at him for a moment, wondering if he might have heard something about the investigation on the law enforcement circuit.
"Not yet," I said. "That's too bad," he said.
I nodded in agreement. "Well, I gotta get back in. Good to see you, Harry."
"You too,"
We should try to get the girls together again.
Sure. We had daughters the same age, but his apparently still talked to him on a regular basis. After all, he put bad people in jail. I got them out. I entered the court, privately chiding myself for the negative thoughts. I tried to remember Legal Siegel's admonishment to let the guilt go so I could be at my best in defending Lacoste. After the jury was reseated, I called the first witness for the defense. Valenzuela walked to the witness stand, bouncing his palm along the top of the front rail of the jury box as he went. He acted as though testifying at a murder trial was as routine as buying smokes at the 7-Eleven. He took the oath and spelled his name for the clerk. I took it from there, asking him first to tell the jury what he did for a living.
"Well," he responded, "you might say I'm a man of many talents. I'm the oil that keeps the justice system moving smoothly."
I almost corrected him by suggesting that he actually meant he was the grease that kept the system moving, but I held back. He was my witness, after all. Instead, I asked him to be more specific about his work.
"For one thing, I'm a state-licensed bail bondsman," he said. "I also got my PI license, and I use that for process. And if you go down to the second-floor coffee shop in this building, then I'm the leaseholder on that. I'm with my brother on that deal, so..."
"Let's go back for a moment," I interrupted. "What is a PI license?"
"Private investigator. You gotta have a state license if you want to do that kind of work."
"Okay, and what do you mean when you say you use your license for process?"
Process. You know, process serving. Like when people get sued and stuff, and the lawyer has to put out a subpoena if he wants to call somebody to come in to give a statement or a deposition or come to trial so they can testify. Like what I'm doing right now."
"So you deliver the subpoena to the witness?"
"Yes, like that. That's what I do."
For all his years spent being the oil in the machine, it was pretty clear that Valenzuela did not have much experience testifying. His answers were choppy and incomplete. Whereas I thought he would be one of the easier witnesses to question, I found myself having to work extra hard with him to get a complete answer to the jury. It was not the perfect way to start the defense case, but I pressed on, annoyed more with myself than with him for not conducting a practice run-through beforehand. "Okay, now did your work as a process server bring you in contact with the victim in this case, Gloria Dayton?" Valenzuela frowned. What I believed was a straightforward question had thrown him for a loop.
"Well, it did, but at the time I didn't know it. What I mean is, her name wasn't Gloria Dayton at the one and only time I came in contact with her, you see."
"You mean she was using a different name?"
"Yes, she was. The name that was on the subpoena I delivered to her was Giselle Dallinger. That's who I served paper on."
"Okay, and when was that?"
"That was on Monday, November 5th at 6:06 in the evening at the lobby entrance of the apartment building on Franklin where she lived."
"You seem pretty precise about the time and place you did this. How can you be so sure?"
"Because I document every service in case somebody doesn't show up for court or for a depo. Then I will be able to tell the lawyer or the judge that, see, sure enough, the person was served and should have been there. I show them the record and I show them the picture, which has the date and timestamp on it."
"You take a photo?"
"Yep, that's my policy."
"So you took a photograph of Giselle Dallinger after you served her with a subpoena last November 5th.
"That's right."
I then produced an 8x10 copy of the date and time-stamped photo that Valenzuela had taken of Giselle, nay Gloria, and asked the judge to accept it as the first defense exhibit. Forsythe objected to the inclusion of the photo and was willing to stipulate that Valenzuela had served a subpoena on Gloria Dayton. But I fought for the photo because I wanted the jurors to see it. The judge sided with me, and I handed the photo to juror number one so it could be examined and then passed from juror to juror. More than anything else, this was what I wanted to accomplish with Valenzuela on the stand. The image was key because it did more than bring validity to Valenzuela's story. It also captured a look of fear in Gloria's eyes that had to be seen
and not testified to. The photo was taken at precisely the moment she looked up from having read the subpoena. She had seen the name Moya in the styling of the case. Hector Aronde Moya versus Arthur Rollins, Warden, FCI Victorville. And in that instant, she had been struck with fear. I wanted the jury to see that look and to surmise that it was fear without me or a witness having to tell them.
Mr. Valenzuela, who were you delivering that subpoena for? I asked.
I was working for an attorney named Sylvester Fulgoni Jr., he responded.
I half expected Valenzuela to add to his answer the improvisation about Fulgoni being the attorney who put the F.U. in litigation, but luckily he spared the jury that. Maybe he was finally getting the hang of being a witness.
And what was the case the subpoena was attached to?
It was called Moya versus Rollins.
A convicted drug dealer named Hector Moya was trying to...
Forsythe objected and asked to approach the judge's bench.
He obviously didn't want the jury hearing any part of what Valenzuela wanted to say. The judge waved us up and turned on the noise-canceling fan.
Judge, where is this going?
Forsythe asked.
With his very first witness, Mr. Haller is trying to hijack this murder case and take us into another, completely unrelated litigation. I've held back on my objections, but now we have to stop this.
I noted his use of we, as though he and the judge shared the responsibility of keeping me in check.
Your Honor, I said, Mr. Forsythe wants to stop this because he knows exactly where I am going with it, and it's a place that he knows is going to derail his whole case. The case Gloria Dayton was served on is exceedingly germane to this case and this trial, and the entire defense theory is built on it. I am asking you to let me proceed, and soon enough you will understand why the state wants to block this.
Exceedingly, Mr. Haller?
Yes, Your Honor, exceedingly.
She gave it a moment's thought and then nodded.
Overruled. You may proceed, Mr. Haller, but get there soon.
We returned to our positions, and I asked Valenzuela the question again.
Like I said, Moya versus Rollins. Rollins is the warden of the prison in Victorville where Hector Moya's been for like 7 or 8 years. He's trying to get out on account that the DEA set him up by planting a...
Forsythe objected again, which seemed to annoy the judge. He asked for a sidebar once more, but the judge said no. He had to state his objection in open court.
As far as I know, Judge, the witness is not an attorney, but he is giving a legal interpretation of a habeas case and about to offer, as fact, the allegations that are merely contained in a lawsuit. We all know that anybody can say anything in a lawsuit. Just because it is said doesn't...
Okay, Mr. Forsythe, the judge said.
I think you've made your objection clear to the jury.
Now I wished he had gotten the sidebar. Forsythe had expertly used the objection to undercut Valenzuela's testimony before he had even given it. He reminded the jury in real time that Moya versus Rollins was just a lawsuit that contained allegations, not proven facts.
I'm going to overrule the objection and let the witness finish his answer, Lego said.
In a slightly deflated tone, I told Valenzuela to give his answer again, and he summarized the main charge of Moya's habeas petition, that the gun that ended up putting him away for life had been planted by the DEA.
Thank you, I said when the answer was finally out and in the record. What did you do after you served Giselle Dallinger with that subpoena?
Valenzuela looked confused by the question.
I guess I told Mr. Fulgoni that it was done, he said.
Okay, and did you ever see Ms. Dallinger again? I asked.
No, not at all. That was it.
When did you next hear about Ms. Dallinger after November 5th?
It would have been about a week later when I heard that she'd gotten murdered.
How did you hear that?
Mr. Fulgoni told me.
And did you learn anything else about her death?
Well, yeah. I read the paper and I saw that a guy had been arrested.
You're talking about Andre Lacoste being arrested for her murder.
Yeah, it had it in the paper.
And how did you react to that news when you read it?
Well, it was like I was relieved, because it meant that we didn't have nothing to do with it.
What do you... Forsythe objected again, citing relevance. I argued that Valenzuela's reaction to news of the murder and arrest were relevant, because the defense's case was based on the fact that the subpoena that was served on Gloria Dayton was what motivated her murder. Lego allowed me to proceed subject to her determining relevancy after the witness's testimony was completed. This was a win with an asterisk for me. Even if the judge later struck Valenzuela's answers from the trial record, she wouldn't be able to strike them from the memories of the 12 jurors. Go ahead, Mr. Valenzuela, I said. Tell the jury why you were relieved when you heard that Mr. Lacoste had been arrested in the murder.
Well, because it meant it had nothing to do with this other thing. You know, the Moya case.
Well, why would you have been worried about that in the first place?
Because Hector Moya is a cartel guy, and I thought, you know, that...
I think I'm going to stop the witness there, Lego said. Now we are getting into an area beyond the witness's expertise and knowledge. Ask a different question, Mr. Haller.
But I had no more questions. For all his unpolished delivery, Valenzuela had been an A-plus witness, and I felt good about how we had come out of the gate. I turned the floor over to Forsythe for cross-examination, but he was wise enough to pass. There wasn't much he could get out of questioning Valenzuela without one of them repeating things that supported the defense theory.
I have no questions, Your Honor, he said.
The judge excused Valenzuela, and he made his way out of the courtroom. Lego told me to call my next witness.
Your Honor, I said, this might be a good time to break for lunch.
Really, Mr. Haller, Lego said. Why is that? The clock says it's 11:40.
Judge, my next witness is not here yet, and if I could have the lunch hour, I'm sure I can have him here to start the afternoon session.
Very well. The jury is excused until 1:00.
I moved back toward the defense table while the jury filed out of the courtroom. Forsythe gave me a look and shook his head as I moved by him.
You don't know what you just did, do you? He whispered.
What are you talking about? I asked. He didn't answer, and I kept moving. At the defense table, I started gathering my legal pads and documents together. I knew better than to leave anything on the table during court breaks. The moment the door closed on the last juror, the judge's voice boomed through the courtroom.
Mr. Haller!
I looked up.
Yes, Your Honor?
Mr. Haller, how would you like to join your client for lunch in lockup?
I smiled, still not aware of any trespass that I had committed.
Well, I wouldn't mind the company, but cheese sandwiches aren't on my list of culinary favorites.
Then let me put you on notice, Mr. Haller. You never suggest a lunch break or any break in front of my jury. Do you understand that?
I do now, Judge.
This is my courtroom, Mr. Haller, not yours. And I decide when we break for lunch and when we don't.
Yes, Your Honor, I apologize, and it won't happen again.
If it does, there will be consequences.
The judge then left the bench in a huff, her black robes flowing behind her. I gathered myself and looked over at Forsythe, who had a sneaky smile on his face. He'd obviously worked in Lego's courtroom before and knew her personal rules of decorum. Big deal, I thought. At least she waited until the jury was gone before she brought out the hammer. When I got out of the courtroom and into the hallway, I found Cisco pacing near the elevators. He was holding his cell phone to his ear, but not talking.
Where the fuck is Fulgoni? I demanded.
I don't know, Cisco said. He said he'd be here. I'm on hold with his office.
He's got 1 hour. He'd better be here.
Chapter 31. Kendall had left before the lunch break to head up to the valley and her shift at Flex. Lorna and I walked down Spring and then over to Maine to a place called Pete's Cafe. Along the way, I occasionally looked back over my shoulder to make sure we had security with us. Moya's men were always there. We'd chosen Pete's because it was good and fast and it served an excellent BLT, which for some reason I was craving. The only issue I ever had with eating at Pete's was that it was always full of cops, and this time was no different. Just a couple blocks from the police administration building, the restaurant was a favorite with command staff suits and detectives from the elite robbery homicide division squads. I exchanged awkward nods and stares with a few guys I recognized from prior trials and cases. We got a table that was cut off from the view of most of the restaurant by a wide support column, and that was fine with me. I was beginning to feel like I had wandered into an enemy encampment when all I wanted was a BLT on whole wheat toast. Lorna was smart enough to ask me if I wanted her to be quiet while I thought about the case and the day's after-lunch session. But I told her there was no sense in my strategizing a plan for the afternoon until I knew whether Sly Jr. was going to be in court as he was supposed to be. So, after ordering, we spent the time studying my calendar and looking for billable hours. The firm was running out of money. Before it was known that there would be no more gold bars coming from André Lacasse, I had spent liberally on P&I, trial preparation, and investigation. More was going out than was coming in, and that was a problem. This was one reason that Jennifer Aronson was not in court this morning. I could not afford to take her off the work for the few other paying clients we had. She spent the morning at a bankruptcy hearing regarding the owner-landlord of the loft we used for our team meetings. At least the credit card I used to pay for lunch went through. I could only imagine the humiliation that would have come from my card being confiscated and cut in half in front of an audience of cops. The good news was then doubled when I got a text from Cisco on our way back to the courthouse. "He's here. Good to go." I shared the news with Lorna that Fulgoni was in the courthouse and was then able to relax the rest of the way back. That is, until Lorna brought up the thing we had steadfastly avoided bringing up for nearly 2 months.
"Mickey, do you want me to start looking around for a driver?"
I shook my head. "I don't want to talk about it right now. Besides, I don't have a car. What do I want a driver for? Are you saying you no longer want to drive me?" She had been picking me up each morning and taking me to court. Usually it was Cisco who drove me home so he could check the house to make sure it was clear.
"No, it's not that," Lorna said. "I don't mind driving you at all. But how long are you going to wait before you try to get back to normal?"
The trial had been a good salve on my internal wounds left by the crash. The attention it required kept my mind from wandering back to that day we had gone up into the Mojave. "I don't know," I said. "Besides, we can't afford normal. There's no money for a driver, and there's no money for a car until I get the check from the insurance company." The insurance check was held up by the investigation. The California Highway Patrol had classified the crash as a homicide caused by the intentional hit and run by the tow truck. The truck was found a day after the accident, parked in a field in Hesperia, and burned to a charred hulk. It had been stolen from a tow lot the morning of the crash. The CHP investigators, as far as I knew, had no line on who had been driving the truck when it had rammed into my Lincoln. As Sylvester Fulgoni Jr. made the long walk from the rear entrance all the way to the witness stand at the front, he swiveled his head back and forth, as if seeing the inside of a real courtroom for